Welcome to the Foresight Health Roundup podcast, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Berta, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Thursday, August 21st. We're still not talking about the Epstein files on today's show, but you may be talking about them tomorrow as the Justice Department says it will start sharing some of the files with a congressional committee. You know, the files that existed, then didn't exist, then were fabricated, then now exist again. I think it was Mark Twain who once said, if you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything. Well, we always tell the truth on the Foresight Health Roundup podcast, and today we're going to hear the truth about the Medicare and Medicaid programs from Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you two doing this morning? Dave?
Hanging in there, Dave. Surviving these dog days of August. One day at a time.
Yeah, it's beautiful out today. Thanks. Julie, how are you?
I'm good. I'm about to fly my firstborn to Ohio for college tomorrow. So, you know, it's a little stressful around here. Yeah, tearful, stressful.
Yeah, we've got neighbors on both sides doing exactly the same thing. So, the touching moment.
You'll have to put one of those signs in your front yard, Julie, that I never used to see, but now see everywhere, you know, future Penn State, Ohio State, Miami of Ohio, Canyon, whichever one it is.
Right.
Canyon.
Should have bought into that business. It's a good one.
Yeah, no kidding.
All right. Yeah. Now, I wasn't going to do an icebreaker today, but Dave, you suggested one, so it's a good one. I'm going to ask you something here. I have no idea what you're going to say. If you could, who would you invite to sing the Star Spangled Banner at Trump's White House extravaganza, which will be complete with a UFC championship match on July 4th, 2026, celebrating the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence? Who wants to try that? Dave, you want to go first?
Sure. I'll go first. And it would be Bob Dylan, but it wouldn't be Bob Dylan today. It would be the Bob Dylan of 1964 when he played the electric guitar at the Newport Folk Festival and pissed everybody off. What would that Bob Dylan do at that ridiculous event that they're going to have to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence? That's what I'd do.
That's a good choice. Well, Julie, how about you?
Because the real people wouldn't do it, I would find the best covers for Bruce Springsteen and Taylor Swift and anyone else who has a little bit of a spat going on with Donald. Yeah, and put them in the
spine.
Ring. That'd be fun.
A spine.
Yeah, they certainly get under his skin. That's great. My choice would be Roseanne Barr.
Yes.
Because she sang this national anthem before a 1990s Padres game, and it was a complete and utter disaster. Now, I don't really have a transition into the topic. Maybe I'll use the word disaster here. You know, speaking of disasters, you know, maybe they are, maybe they aren't. As you both know, the Medicare and Medicaid programs turned 60 on July 30th. LBJ signed the programs into law on July 30th, 1965. I was but 5 years old. We mentioned their anniversary briefly on our July 31st show, but today we're going to go deeper on both. I'm going to ask each of you three questions. What's the program's biggest success? What's the program's biggest failure? And what's the biggest policy change you would make to the programs if you were HHS secretary? You know, like a real HHS secretary, not some addle-brained, uninformed, uneducated anti-vaxxer whose own cousin says you're unfit for the job. Dave, you get to go first. Biggest success, biggest failure, and biggest policy change.
Well, I'm going to focus just on Medicare because it's a big topic. And Medicaid is another whole ball of wax. So if you'll grant me that license, Dave, I'll get started.
Of course, yeah.
The biggest successes are easy. Greater access, elimination of worry, reduced financial burden. When it was enacted in 65, medical costs for the elderly, the 65 plusers, were triple the cost of those for younger adults. And you had all of the expected things happening. Elderly people exhausted their financial resources, put them into poverty. They placed excessive care burdens on their families. And many avoided necessary care. And the creation of Medicare did away with all that. So it brought sanity to the delivery of healthcare services, at least from the patient's perspective, to the elderly in America. The failures, I'm actually not sure, Dave, we could have created a less efficient way to deliver healthcare than the Medicare enacting legislation for the elderly. The list of failures is long, and I'll tick them off. In first one, enshrining fee-for-service payment was called cost-plus in those days. For perpetuity, the U.S. has the worst of all possible business models for healthcare services. We've got centralized pricing formularies that are very complex, created through CMS in Maryland, that a ferocious free market exploits in any and every way it can. So number two, Medicare initially covered all capital funding costs for hospitals. Remember that? So guess what happened? We saw an explosion in the nation's acute care footprint. You say it's free? Okay, I'll take it. Third thing, the legislation made Blue Cross Blue Shield the primary third-party administrator for Medicare programs throughout the country. That's in part why the Blue Cross building in downtown Chicago is 57 stories high, and they're the CEO of HCSC, which owns Illinois Blue Cross Blue Shield, makes over $20 million a year. Third thing, under Medicare, the AMA determines physicians' fee schedules. In 1965, two-thirds of the U.S. doctors were primary care physicians. Today, two-thirds are specialists. They're in it for the money. So is it really any surprise that the nation confronts a shortfall of PCPs? Fourth thing, Medicare direct and indirect graduate medical education payments have largely kept the 1920s era medical training model for doctors intact. It is woefully out of date and really needs to be overhauled from top to bottom. But that's not going to happen as long as the government money keeps flowing in. Fifth thing, this will be my final one. Medicare's mechanics for creating pricing formularies has spawned the creation of a massive healthcare industrial complex, something we talk about a lot, certainly the largest ever created by human beings. And that complex, that industrial complex, has captured the legislative and regulatory processes of not only federal, but state governments to the detriment of the U.S. people. So altogether, these features explain in large measure why healthcare expenditures have grown from 5% of GDP in 1960 to 18% today, and why the U.S. spends twice as much per capita as other advanced economies with shorter life expectancy and worse health outcomes. In the U.S., we've never had the institutional wherewithal to stop special interests from shaping Medicare's governance and mechanics, and to our detriment. So what should we do about all that? And I'm going to be brief, but basically, we need to implement large mandatory participation programs through CMMI that reward better outcomes, lower costs, and better customer/patient experiences. We need to make public health as, or even more important than healthcare delivery. In essence, we need to create more health in this country, so we need less healthcare, and make sure the healthcare services we do deliver are both effective and efficient.
That was a good trip down memory lane, too. What did they used to call it? The capital pass-through, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like getting a surcharge on your restaurant bill that says for the tariff, right? All right. Julie, any questions for Dave?
Well, Dave, I got to tell you, I heard a little bit of Maha there at the end, so that was interesting. So, Dave, my question for you might be rhetorical, but, you know, the Health Affairs article that I read came out with what it called CMMI's new direction, new strategic direction, three priorities for success. Mm-hmm. This came out this week.
I saw it.
One of the three priorities was protecting the taxpayer. And seeing that alongside the priorities of increased patient engagement, huge. Leverage data and technology, huge. It kind of took me aback for a second to read protect the taxpayer. So talk to me about how you read this and, you know, why they've made this one of the top three priorities.
I'm going to take you back a little bit. In the run-up to the 2012 presidential election, then Indiana governor and former OMB head under first Bush, Mitch Daniels, was a leading candidate for president. And Mitch's big thing was, when he was governor and also when he was at OMB, was how do we do more for the people without increasing taxes? So we got the same amount of resources. How do we do more with them? Which is a really great way to look at solving problems. So around that time, I got addicted to something called Mitch TV. And he was going around to community groups and so on. He had some aide with a camcorder, you know, recording his sayings. It was, you know, early internet and coverage wasn't always great, but I just found it mesmerizing. And he was at one session on Mitch TV that I was watching where he was pushing an agenda. I can't remember what the item was, but what I do remember is he quoted the motto of the Special Olympics, which I hadn't heard before. And that motto is, let me win, but if I cannot win, let me be brave in the attempt. Let me win, but if I cannot win, let me be brave in the attempt. And I don't think we've ever as a nation been brave in the attempt to take on the healthcare industrial complex and really solve the healthcare challenges that are confronting the nation and wreaking havoc with healthcare delivery and our population health for the country and so on. So we need to be brave in the attempt.
Yep. Too many vested interests preventing that. Thanks, Dave. Okay, Julie, it's your turn. Medicare and Medicaid turned 60 last month. Give me their biggest success and biggest failure and the biggest policy change you'd make as HHS secretary.
Well, I'm going to take a slightly different approach to this than Dave did, but take us back in time a little bit. You know, Dave, this, of course, was all before I was born. But when we look back.
That's okay. Twist the knife. We're fine with it.
It's our fault. Yes. It's our fault. Dave was five at the time.
Exactly. It seems to me from all I've read that Medicare was born out of two things, a very familiar social movement that we wrestle with all the time called universal healthcare, right? Dave, to your point. And this was just simply a compromise, right? And the second, it was born out of segregation in a big way because way back when, you know, we white people got care before Black people even had a chance. And Black people didn't have access to the same, you know, hospital and, you know, other services that white people did. And I mean, Black doctors, don't even get me started about that. So, and by the way, on top of that, Medicaid was literally a footnote, and I will talk about it, Dave, but it barely registered, you know, in this bill compared to Medicare. So with that backdrop, I was trying to think about, you know, what's been the biggest success and failure as you look at those origins. And I mean, successfully, this obviously did lift millions of Americans out of poverty and has, you know, I think really shifted the way we think about financial security and has definitely impacted life expectancy. So there's been a lot of good for society, but obviously I can't even do justice to what Dave just said about the biggest failure, which is, of course, the fact that it created this enormous fee-for-service engine that has been a fiscal mismanagement nightmare for the country. And we've just embedded these bad habits around volume that have, I mean, frankly, one of the biggest failures is we've failed to keep up with tech innovations and environmental changes in a way that helps the program be better. The program almost is what it is despite any good that's happened around it. I will say, though, that there's a partial success, partial failure here. We no longer talk about segregation of care, but we continue to have access challenges, you know, across different races and socioeconomic and significant disparities of care. And we're not allowed to talk about this right now, but, you know, I think there's still a lot of progress has happened here when you look at where we were with care delivery racially back when Medicare was passed, but we still have a lot of problems. And we're not doing enough to really address what we need to understand to fix them. But I do think Medicare has come a long way to address that. So I'm going to park that there because I can't even do justice to what Dave did. On the Medicaid side, you know, the footnote, you know, you can't deny the fact that Medicaid has basically been a huge driver, I think, for health equity. And obviously it's become our safety net. I think the one thing that has been most successful, even though when you compare our stats to the, you know, other Western countries were abysmal, but the impact on maternal and child health has been notable, you know, despite being far from perfect. And that's huge. It's huge that Medicaid has contributed so much to that. The failures I could just list, you know, all day long around the corner over a drink. But the patchwork of state-based management here and the variation in just completely subpar reimbursement rates have led to just massive fragmentation, inequity in just many ways, not just kind of state-driven ways, and massive political instability, which is what we're seeing today, right? It's a very fragile system, and it's been misinterpreted since the beginning and tied to concepts of welfare that Medicaid doesn't really even really compare to. And we're seeing that today with all the cuts. So the political instability, I think, might be one of the biggest failures, which is, of course, all driven by the fact that it's state-run, but also partially federally funded, and we haven't figured out, you know, who's on first and who calls the shot. So as our friend MLK would say, we've come a long, long way, but we still have a long, long way to go. So if I were sitting in the seat right now, it's interesting, by the way, you know, one of the things, of course, I think I would want to do is shift as much of the funds to value with some guardrails in place as possible. And frankly, that's what they're trying to do in today's administration. They're trying to shift to value. So, you know, I think that's great. The two other things I think are really important is expanding these telehealth flexibilities permanently. Like, we have technology, we have the organizational capabilities to do this. Let's get the reimbursement set up to do it right. So let's reflect today's lifestyle and our capabilities with site of care. And Medicaid, you know, this, the whole redetermination thing has been such a disaster. And I'm now talking to health systems about their desperate need to figure out enrollment, certainly in states like North Carolina, and trying to really be part of the solution of streamlining enrollment. I mean, both red and blue states struggle with this. So this should be a nonpartisan thing to streamline enrollment. And anything we can do on maternal and child health is a good thing. So, you know, coverage for 12 months for postpartum, and just really looking at how do we do better there? Because all the research points to beginning of life is so critical.
Yeah, it all starts with the patient, right? Thanks, Julie. Dave, any questions for Julie?
Great. Just great assessment. So here's my question. Oddly enough, in 1972, during the Nixon administration, Congress enacted universal coverage for end-stage renal disease, irrespective of age, so kidney care. And they did that under Medicare by amending the Social Security Act. So here we are 54 years later. What can we say about the successes and failures of this uniquely American version of socialized medicine?
Well, Dave, if I'm following your question, this has been the epitome of a runaway business success and created two of the most successful private and then, you know, public companies in DaVita and Fresenius. And, you know, dialysis companies were like, they drove everything for a solid decade there. And those dialysis companies also were two of the slowest to really think about different sites of care and evolving with what the patients really wanted and needed. And frankly, what some of the patients really needed, because of the inconvenience of going to a dialysis center. So capitalism and universal coverage just don't mix in America. We haven't put the right guardrails in place to focus on what is needed versus the business that can be built.
Well, as Upton Sinclair said, it's really hard to get someone to understand something when you're paying them not to understand it. And these dialysis centers are all about the click, right? And pushing people through as fast as they can, whether it's in their best interest or not. And, you know, Europe and Australia and other advanced economies, they're doing much more dialysis in the home. you know, would be really something if we could ever unleash the American innovation engine on healthcare with the right incentives in place. We ought to be smart enough to do that.
We are smart enough. I'm a capitalist. I believe in entrepreneurs. Like this is entrepreneurs have changed our lives in every way. When we look around us, I mean, every single way, and they're changing healthcare today as well. And we see it. However, there are guardrails that are not in place. There's just a kind of a lack of really looking at certain actors as being driving forces here. And it's so possible. And I see goodness every day. It's not all good.
I am not a historian, but I was watching a rebroadcast of the Roosevelt's documentary by Ken Burns this week. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that, but it's great. FDR passed the Social Security Act in 1935, which we mentioned last week. He also passed the National Labor Relations Act. LBJ, like we said, passed Medicare and Medicaid. That's in addition to the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. Obama passed the Affordable Care Act, and Biden passed the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. And now we have the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. So where did we go wrong? Now let's talk about other big healthcare news that happened this week. Julie, what else happened this week that we should know about?
Well, for anyone following Epic's UGM, it happened in Wisconsin this week, and they announced 160 or more AI projects and really focused on clinical agents. Like they went hard on it. Launching products called weird names like Art and Emmy and Penny. And Judy was apparently dressed up like Buzz Lightyear. So, you know, good times. And by the way, the bottom line of what Epic announced basically is a signal to the market that they're going to get into every market, ERP, revenue cycle, like they're taking over the world. So it'll be interesting to see whether it truly stalls, you know, some of the innovation community, or we're going to see hospitals who really understand that this is a longer term vision, and it's nice, but let's see it.
Yeah, I think that's a topic for next week's show.
Right? Great.
Start thinking. Dave, what's your big story of the week?
Well, there's so much going on per usual, you know, among other things, the workers at the CDC fighting back against RFK after the shooting there a couple of weeks ago or a week ago, and then 800 people signing a letter. Something to watch there. And the Governor Abbott looking to stop shipments of abortion-preventing drugs into Texas, obviously a big thing to follow. But what caught my attention today was the daily email from the Harvard Gazette magazine, and the three stories in it were all health or healthcare related. The first story is about how the U.S. fertility rate is down 22% since its peak in 2007 and what to do about it. The second was an interview with Dr. David Kessler, former FDA commissioner and author of The End of Overeating. In the interview, Dr. Kessler discusses the science underlying GLP drugs and his personal experience with drugs, as well as his new book, Diet, Drugs, and Dopamine. Gotta love the alliteration there. The third article was on robotic doctors, of all things. You know, Dave, we could do a roundup podcast on any of those topics, and maybe we should.
Right, right. Healthcare, the gift that keeps on giving for 60 years and probably more. Thanks, Dave, and thanks, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed on today's show, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can subscribe to the Roundup on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta from Foresight Health.